Thank you.
Okay. Hi. So I'm from literary studies. So I'm going to be speaking much more about the representation of animal emotion than animal emotions themselves. And today I really want to look at children's animal fiction. And I think there are two essential ideas we tend to have about children's animal fiction, especially that which is focused on interspecies relations. First, there is a really long-standing critical tradition that says that these texts are usually formed as ways to instill moral lessons in the child reader. As Tess Coslett says, talking animal stories in particular assume a similarity of consciousness between children and animals, and in particular, she says, they sort of assume emotional similarity. So she says, in assuming for the most part that animal consciousness is similar to human consciousness, or that it can serve as a metaphor for animal consciousness, the sort of stories she's looking at deploy various analogies between animals and types or classes of humans. The child analogy is the most obvious. Most books, she says, address themselves to children and provide examples of good and bad behavior to animals by child characters, but they also use animal behavior and attitudes to give moral lessons on child behavior. So the assumption of similarity works in two directions. On the one hand, we have animal behavior being used as a model for human behavior. And there's a huge amount of literature out there which suggests that one of the reasons so much children's fiction is focused on non-human animals, it's about 75% of picture books, it stays similarly high for sort of chapter books, is the argument has always been it's easier for children to empathize or identify with non-human animals than fictional humans, whether because both children and animals are ostracized from an adult world, or because children are small, or something like that. Non-human animals, says one critic, provide the moral foundation for children. More recently, a couple studies have called this into question. It turns out that actually reading about animals learning to share doesn't teach children how to share any better than reading about humans do. But still, that's the critical tradition. We also have the sense that reading about non-human animals encourages feelings of empathy and pity, specifically in terms of wishing to lessen animal suffering. And we get the same bidirectional movement with the other essential idea we have about children's animal fiction, which is that it teaches children about death. Because what we know, what we remember about the animal stories of our childhood is that animals die. If there is a dog, it is going to die. The child protagonist is going to mourn. The child reader is also going to mourn, and they're going to learn something about their own mortality. When I teach a module on animal studies, I begin with this image of the king of the elephants eating a poisonous mushroom and growing ill, because this terrifies me to this day. It gave me nightmares for years, right? There's this sort of crucial identification. But we also have a very common story, probably just as common now, where there's a human character who dies, usually a parent, and a dog appears, almost always a dog in this case, is what one critic calls a transforming substance. The dog acts as a catalyst who loves the child and helps the child learn to incorporate themselves in the world to love again. So what I want to suggest with this pretty abstract discussion is that there are two central emotional relations between humans and non-human animals in children's literature. Children either learn empathy for the suffering animal, or animals express empathy for the suffering child. But in either case, suffering is the point of emotional empathy. And this, in a lot of ways, isn't really surprising. The same is definitely true of adult fiction. If you look at two very recent examples, you might expect that Grief is the Thing with Feathers, which is about a crow, might be about grief. Happiness sounds much cheerier. It's about urban foxes in London. No, it's about grief too. It's always about suffering. And I've been working on animal fiction for about 5 years. It's fairly new for me. I keep coming back to this question of why it is that suffering is seen as the linchpin of interspecies communication. And of course, there's a very long tradition with this. We could go back to Jeremy Bentham, who says that suffering is the sort of rationale for being free of torment. We could go to Derrida, we could go to Peter Singer, all of them in very different ways, whether looking at non-power, looking at the use of things that aren't linguistically constructed. They all say that suffering has to be the point of understanding between species. And this is all to the good. I think it will overlap with most of what we're talking about this weekend. But I think it has some really odd effects. There's a prominent philosopher who argues in favor of animal suffering. There's always one. And a guy named Stephen Budiansky. And he says that only conscious reflection on suffering is a grounds for compassion. If there isn't reflection, then we shouldn't worry about it. And another thinker named Matthew Scully says, yeah, but Budiansky probably goes home and plays with his dogs at the end. We know that Descartes really liked dogs even though he thought they were automata. So there becomes a separation between this idea of suffering on the one hand and the being who suffers on the other. And what gets lost in this discussion for both sides is the specificity of the individual who suffers. For Elisa Aretola, the solution to this sort of impasse is a greater focus on emotion. She says, our capacity to see animal suffering in a new light, or to see it at all, depends on our willingness to include emotion. And if theory rejects this inclusion, it may act as a blindfold rather than as a motive for advocacy. This means that the negative image attached to sentimentality needs to be expunged. Here, emotion need not be of the overwhelming and tearful kind, but can simply constitute ability to take into account and share the viewpoint of other beings. Hence, empathy gives birth to morality by making us see what is valuable in the world. Moreover, it helps to understand the self, the world, and others. I think the progression in this argument is really fascinating, and working backwards through it, Aretola concludes that morality stems from empathy, and that empathy crosses species lines. And I would hope most of us might agree with that. And she clarifies that this empathy comes both from reason and emotion. It's fellow feeling more than something directed like pity or sympathy. And yet her starting point for emotion is to re-embrace sentimentality. Pity, suffering are still at the heart of empathy. As Nicole Seymour has recently argued, the problem with sentimentality might be that it's often attached to a negative image, but that it's just too easy. Accounts of non-human animals that rely on sentimentality, she says, have a particular affective pull. And she says she's much more interested in how cultural works demonstrate that one may perversely resist the pulls of that object or experience them in unexpected ways. And we don't have to go as far as Seymour's focus on the perverse and the camp to see this. We could go back to Darwin, where we were just a few moments ago, who really does focus on the humorous and the playful in a lot of his discussion of cross-species emotion. And of course, we have many accounts of this. You could look at Vicky Hearn's argument that all happiness is animal happiness. You could look at Brian Massumi's argument that all language comes from animal play. But what remains really curious to me is that this sense of wonder that you get in Darwin, in Hearn, in Massumi, really isn't taken seriously in children's animal fiction or in the criticism about it. If suffering is often positioned as the sentiment we have to take seriously, joy is often seen as a much lesser, a much more frivolous sentiment, one that might not sort of deserve detailed consideration, one which might not cross species lines in the same way. So what I want to do with the time remaining is look at two fairly canonical children's novels, one that's recent, known as a comic novel, one that's older, known for its focus on mourning and suffering, and look at how focusing on wonder and joy might lead to a slightly different way of reading these sorts of texts. So Kate DiCamillo's Flora and Ulysses, The Illuminated Adventures, which is illustrated by K.G. Campbell, opens with a sequence in the style of a graphic novel. There's a high-powered Hoover, which destroys a book of poetry. Then the novel switches into prose to introduce its human protagonist, Flora Buckman, that's her right there, who loves comic books, and her mother really dislikes them. We have all of these lines being blurred between illustration and prose, between comics and so-called proper literature. And Hoover ends up swallowing a squirrel, who at the moment of his apparent death thinks solely of his hunger. After a momentary vision of squirrel heaven, though, the squirrel comes back with superpowers, including flying, super strength, increased intellect, and of course, the most important one, writing poetry. The first indication of his strength comes in another graphic interlude, which you can see here, where he's shown lifting the Hoover over his head, and this is why he's given the name Ulysses. This is what's called in picture book scholarship a blended narrative, where prose and image are both contributing crucial elements of the narrative. And the blending isn't arbitrary. It's essential to interpreting the text. There isn't, the text is saying, a right way to see the world. And traditional anthropocentric narratives might be failing us. Indeed, in a different context, Susan McHugh mentions squirrel poetry specifically as the limit of the animal turn in contemporary criticism. She says, although no one to date seriously argues that squirrels write poetry, animals are being reconceptualized as key players in all sorts of ways. But I do want to argue that squirrels write poetry. Ulysses' poetry is not just a cultural production in its own right. It connects him with a larger literary world. He discovers a typewriter, and he discovers it with unabashed joy. He types his first word, which is Squirtle, and the caption reads, "His whiskers trembled, his heart sang. Was he fighting evil? Who could say?" His language use isn't simply a way to communicate with the human world. It's a way to move from the constant threat of death that's associated with his squirrel life to something immortal. So like the non-human animals we usually get in children's fiction, Ulysses is always subject to suffering. It was a sad fact of his existence as a squirrel that there was always someone somewhere who wanted him dead. But he wasn't thinking about dying. He was thinking about poetry. So suffering, the threat of death, are presented as constants. But they're not presented sentimentally. And they're not presented as limited to human and non-human encounters. The reader's empathy doesn't come to pity here. Rather, it's a way of understanding how to see the world. And it is language in this novel that specifically allows for this move. But the squirrel also loves the world in a way that sort of passes text and illustration and species boundary. He loved the world. He loved all of it, smoke rings and lonely squids and Flora Bell Buckman's round head and all the wonderful thoughts inside of it. And he writes a poem that's simply a list of words he likes, each of which echoes an earlier incident in the novel, and it's a bad poem. But at the end of the novel, he turns this sort of bad poem into an expression of his love for Flora. And when he recites the poem, it's not included in the text. The scene is illustrated with a two-page spread of all the novel's characters listening, while the poem shows up as an epigraph. The text is about the love between two individuals, but the visual reception, which again we see about 20 pages earlier, expands it to include a much wider, more inclusive community. And I think that this is really crucial. What DiCamillo does isn't just showing human love for an animal or an animal love for a human. Rather, she's showing the way in which any individual, regardless of species, can come to love the world. And the emotional connection between beings is based not on suffering, but on wonder. Literary texts in this novel, DiCamillo keeps suggesting, literary texts can't reveal the truth in themselves, but only as they're read, as they're shared, as they're brought into a community of understanding. If this perhaps does seem fitting for a comic novel, it's perhaps surprising to find the same dynamic in a text like Charlotte's Web, which most of you hopefully know, and its canonical status is due to a clear obsession with death and suffering. From the first line onwards, where's Papa going with that axe? non-human animals are positioned as mortal in a way humans aren't. And what readers tend to remember of the story is how it's about how one non-human animal sacrifices herself in order to save the life of another non-human animal. So the novel seems to be one of the key examples of that sort of moral sentiment I was talking about earlier. It's absolutely infused with death. It can be read very clearly as an account of what makes a good death. One of Wilbur the Pig's early conversations with Charlotte, the genesis of her plan to save him, is when he whispers to her of his own death, beginning to tremble with fear, like a sort of porcine Kierkegaard. He doesn't want to die, he says. He wants to stay in the bar. Of course, says Charlotte. We all do. So if Wilbur's sort of potential death is the narrative center of the novel, Charlotte's actual death is its emotional center. White is insisting that these deaths aren't exceptional, they're universal. Even the summer is dying, sing the crickets in the novel. And yet, although Wilbur is very much the reader surrogate in the novel, he's good, he's innocent, he's lonely, the child character, Ferns, her conversations with animals represents how a child reader might want to envision themselves. Her father assuages fears that Fern might just have an overactive imagination with the sentiment that maybe adult ears simply aren't as finely attuned to animal speech as those of children. But this novel, if you go back, is very odd. We remember the story of Wilbur and Charlotte, but it's set against these really odd product scenes of the PR industry. And it's really hard to balance these two things unless the reader takes seriously White's account of the way all creatures share the same love of the world. And this is the introduction to the passage I was just quoting about trembling with fear. Twilight settled over Zuckerman's barn in a feeling of peace. Fern knew that it was almost supper time, but she couldn't bear to leave. Swallows passed on silent wings in and out of the doorways, bringing food to their young ones. From across the road, a bird sang whippoorwill, whippoorwill. Lurvy sat down under an apple tree and lit his pipe. The animal sniffed the familiar smell of strong tobacco. Wilbur heard the trill of the tree toad and the occasional slamming of the kitchen door. All these sounds made him feel comfortable and happy, for he loved life and loved to be a part of the world on a summer evening. But as he lay there, he remembered what the old sheep had told him. The thought of death came to him, and he began to tremble with fear. The temptation is to skip to the end of the paragraph, because that's where our plot is located. But I think the fact that we have such a long setup is just as important. The world can be loved, and it's not loved just as individuals, but a mixture of beings enmeshed in the land. The combination of different sensory experiences we get here and different creatures suggests that loving the world involves the entanglement of both different species and different sorts of emotion. In their book on animated children's animal films, amongst other things, Jack Halberstam speaks of the importance of not being taken seriously. Being taken seriously, they say, means missing out on the chance to be frivolous, promiscuous, and irrelevant. The desire to be taken seriously is precisely what compels people to follow the tried and true paths of knowledge production around which I would like to map a few detours. And I think this is just as true of our study of the representation of animal and human emotions in children's books. Focusing on suffering and loss and trauma is absolutely crucial, and it certainly instills empathy. But I think the moral lesson we might derive from these sorts of books is that a love of the world must be shared between humans and non-human animals, that it takes place in communion, that it involves all of our different senses, and that it fundamentally rests on ideas of joy and wonder. And I think this idea that the world is shared is something that's really overlooked in studies of children's animal fiction. And focusing on the development or the transformation of both human and non-human protagonists, instead of seeing one in service of the other, might give us some sort of new perspective. That's all for me.
Thanks very much, Tim.